Hello, welcome back to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden. After a short summer break, I'm here talking to Chetan Sehgal, the lead fund manager of Templeton Emerging Markets, which is the oldest and with a market value of nearly £2 billion, the biggest of the global emerging markets investment trusts listed on the London Stock Exchange. Hello, Chetan. Thanks for joining us. You're calling from Singapore, aren't you?
That's right, Gavin. Nice to be on your podcast.
Yes, well, lovely to have you. And you're the first global emerging markets fund manager I've had on the podcast. And it's striking, you know, looking at the asset class, the markets in which you invest, you know, overall, given how challenging a year it's been, the overall performance of emerging markets has proved surprisingly resilient, I think. When I was looking at the figures yesterday, in the emerging markets index, is up a little bit. It was up 1.6%. The shares of your trust were broadly flat. You know, after a sharp rebound from the what was a very tough March, I think. But I think normally we'd expect a lot more, you know, to emerging markets to have fared a lot more badly, given the prospects of a global recession and all the turmoil that's been going on. What's behind this better than expected performance?
Thank you, Gavin. Well, we are surprised as well in terms of the market performance. But, you know, you have to diverse between the market performance and the economies. The economies have suffered quite a lot, especially emerging markets like Brazil, India, which have been impacted by the COVID pandemic. The other markets like China, Korea, Taiwan, which are the other large parts of the GEM universe, there, the impact of COVID has not been that severe, although it's been there as well. But, you know, you have to divorce the markets and the economies, because the markets essentially comprise securities which have very, very little to do with the underlying economy. There's far more tech in the markets, and those secular trends in technology, etc., they still continue and continue very, very strongly in this pandemic. And one can even argue that some of these companies have actually benefited as a result of the pandemic. So it's not that surprising that the overall emerging markets are actually up as compared to the weakness in the economies.
Does that reflect the fact that emerging markets, you know, it's a huge sort of area that gets kind of collated into one sort of simple category, but does that reflect that emerging markets themselves have changed? You know, in the previous years or decades or crises, they would have been more vulnerable because they'd have been more linked to commodities and raw resources, and now the economies are much more sophisticated.
That's right. So if you go back, you know, to the last crisis, which was there in the global financial crisis, energy and materials were over 40% of the index, and now they are a fraction of that. In fact, energy and materials together are less than 15% of the emerging market index. Whereas technology stocks, whether it be communication services, retail, internet retail, you know, those are, and semiconductors and hardware, those are now much larger parts of the index. So those constitute nearly 40% or above 40% of the emerging markets index. And those have in fact benefited as a result of the pandemic. So you know, people are sitting at home, they are playing games, they are watching, you know, internet television, they are doing retail shopping online. The cloud businesses have started doing very well because a lot of the companies are moving their products onto the cloud. So to that extent, the emerging market index today reflects a lot of the new economy, and those have really benefited because of pandemic.
Okay. So, yes, a lot of people have been talking about the new normal. You know, the trends you're referring to, people working from home, having more time to surf on the internet and do online shopping and that sort of thing. You know, these how do you view these changes? Are these short-term changes, or are these profounder long-term changes that we're seeing? And if they're the latter, how are they affecting the emerging markets?
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of both. Some of it is definitely going to be profound and remain for a long time. But, you know, if you make an assumption that we do get a vaccine, which I hope we do, And once all of us are vaccinated, I think there will be for an initial period of time going back to the old ways, because people miss the old ways as well, you know, socializing in pubs and going to the theater, seeing movies, going on vacation, right? How many of us have had a chance to go on vacation this year? So I think many of the real life experiences will come back in vogue once we get a vaccine, etc. But some of the other stuff, like, you know, shopping online and buying groceries online, which are really not very involved decisions, they will become online. And from the company's point of view, they've really found that being on the internet, having cloud, a business on cloud, really actually improves their own performance as well. So those trends may still continue, and you might have a situation where many companies make it optional for their employees to remain in a work from home kind of environment. So, you know, there may not be any rush to go back to offices.
No, I can see that from personal experience. That seems to be the case. I'm not expecting to be working in Cityworld's office regularly until probably next year at this rate. So I better get used to speaking to people like you from my sitting room, which is absolutely fine. But the Templeton Emerging Markets has actually changed quite a lot in recent years. You became lead manager of the investment trust in early 2018. You were after the departure of Carlos Hardenberg, and there have been quite a few changes because obviously probably even now, you know, the investment trust is best known for having been founded and launched and run for many years by Mark Mobius. How has Templeton Emerging Markets changed since Mark Mobius stepped back, which is now 5 years ago?
That's right. So I had the pleasure of working for Mark for over 23 years, and I've learned a lot from Mark. But you know, the market environment has changed, and processes have become more robust over a period of time. So every year, you know, we have learning experiences, and the market has changed as well. So there's been a lot of change that way. A lot of it is continuum, but the market has also changed. So no longer is commodities, energy, materials a very large part of the index. There's more tech businesses which have come in. And many of those have now found their way into our portfolios as compared to previously. So that has been some change which has happened. And there is an evolution because consumer preferences also keep changing. I mean, if you say 5 years back, how much was I buying on the internet as compared to what I'm doing today? There's a big difference in that behavior as well. So I think the trust has also evolved. So, you know, if you go back to the early 90s, and it was very different from what it was in the 2000s, and it's very different from what it was in 2010, and now it is quite different from what it was in 2010. So there's been an evolution of some sort, and on ourselves, I think we pride ourselves in the number of different locations where we are present in. The kind of analysts which we have is basically local analysts who are giving us bottom up information. Our commitment to value as a philosophy has not changed. We are looking at companies which have a sustainable earning power in our portfolio. So that is where our focus is. And we want to buy these companies at a discount to their intrinsic worth. So we remain to being a committed long-term fundamental investor.
Yes, exactly. So some things don't change, but the way that you have moved the portfolio, continue to move the portfolio into technology stocks, growth stocks, has been a really prominent feature, and shareholders have benefited. The performance has improved since those changes were made, since Mark Mobius stepped back, and since you got involved over 2 years ago. But I'm just wondering, we're just speaking right now on Friday morning, Friday the 4th. There's just been a pronounced sell-off in US tech stocks overnight. Who knows where that's... I'm just curious as to where you think that might be going. Is it just a a bit of profit taking after the extraordinary run that some of these big stocks have had? Or could it be the start of something more serious?
Yeah, so, you know, personally, I don't track, or we don't track as an emerging markets group what happens in the US, but we are mindful of the trends. Some of the trends are prevalent in emerging markets as well. And our philosophy is really we have to be aware of what valuations we are paying for the companies which we own. And we are perfectly comfortable owning many of these companies, even at this stage. So yes, there could be corrections which happen. But we are very confident about the long-term prospects of many of the securities which we own.
Yeah, but it's striking, isn't it? I mean, the portfolio, is it fair to say the portfolio is reliant on quite a narrow band of stocks? Some of your best performers are the Taiwanese chipmaker TSMC, Samsung Electronics in South Korea, but in China, Alibaba and Tencent, those internet giants, and there's another company I don't know at all so well, Naver in South Korea, at South Korea's largest internet search engine. You put together those five stocks, that represents about 40% of Templeton Emerging Markets. What is that? Is that you just being, you know, showing your conviction as a stock picker, or is that a little? How safe is that after such a strong run? How are you approaching the valuations of some of these companies when they've been doing so very well?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to philosophy. You know, so we are looking at companies which have sustainable earning power, and we want to buy them at a discount to their worth. So, but there are very few companies which actually go into that filter, because you have technology change, you have trade war issues, you have pandemic, you have so many other issues which are there, and to find companies which really have sustainable earning power, I think is going to be quite difficult. And this is where we are actually positioned in these companies, because we truly believe that these companies have sustainable earning power, and each of them has actually proved their mettle in the downturn as well. So for I'll give you some examples, like for example, TSMC has been a market leader, but for the first time they have gained share and even business from one of their largest competitors, which is Intel, and they've gained leadership. Similarly, Samsung is the lowest cost producer of memory, and as you go into cloud businesses, memory demand is good, and Samsung's the lowest cost position and technology position helps them. They also benefit with the ban on Huawei, because more and more people are using Samsung gear and Samsung phones. So they are quite well positioned there. Similarly, a company like Tencent, they have benefited because of the games. But it's a very unique business model, and people don't realize it, that they started with a game company, then they got into WeChat, which is now in part of some controversy, but then they get into finance, which is, WePay and Tencent Pay. And then they get into video, long-form video, into music. So it's a company which has been able to adapt under various different environments. They also have very large investments in things like JD, Meituan. They also own a chunk of Tesla, and which has done extremely very well for them. So many of these companies have, not only they have been able to evolve their business, and this is what we are looking for, because you don't want to be invested in a company which is a one-trick pony, because the environment may change. You want management teams which have the flexibility to adapt to different environments and come out well. And that's what the Tencent and Alibaba ecosystem have done. You look at a company like Naver, which we own and which you talked about. It started as a search engine. First of all, not many search engines have had a market share greater than Google in any market, and Naver is one of them. But from search, they have evolved into commerce and e-commerce, and they have a Shopify kind of smart store, and now they're doing e-commerce as well. So we are looking for these companies which are able to adopt and adapt and move forward, because we don't want to get stuck in technology which can get obsolete over a period of time.
Okay, so you're confident about the prospects of those five big tech stocks. What changes did you make to the portfolio either during or after the that March sell-off? It presumably provided you with buying opportunities. Were you increasing your stakes in some of these tech companies, or were you using it to find new opportunities?
Yeah, so, you know, coming back to your earlier question, you know, we like these companies, but we are very mindful of valuation because, you know, our job is also to buy these at a discount to their in our assessment of the intrinsic worth. So March actually, so there's a period when we thought that the COVID crisis would be very isolated and China had taken steps to, you know, rein in COVID in a particular province and in Wuhan, etc. So we thought it will be very isolated and it may not become a global pandemic. And to be honest, we were caught a little off guard with the spread of the virus and did not probably act fast enough in some of those actions. And at that point, it basically it happened. The decline in the market happened over a few weeks. You know, and there was a huge amount of, and there was an issue with the oil, the Russia, Saudi Arabia agreement on oil also had fallen through. So we did a little bit pre COVID, and we moved a little bit of the assets out of China into markets into Latin America and we thought that Latin America would be safe because, you know, the virus is in China and the virus will not be able to travel that far. But it reached everywhere. The pandemic spread everywhere. And
Brazil has suffered, countries like Brazil have suffered more than anywhere, I think is what you're
correct.
Saying.
Yeah. So we did get impacted. But the question is not, you know, how you anticipate these changes, because this was very dynamic. The question is, post-pandemic, what do we do? So we reassessed, we had engagement with all our companies. We made changes in our portfolio. So we had, when it was just, China, isolated in China, or when we felt it was really isolated in China, we had reduced exposure to some of the gaming companies and reduced, because we thought that sector will be in trouble. We had reduced some of the banks in China where we felt that, you know, the government will, there'll be an excessive cost which will be borne. So we had reduced banks. And along the way, we've actually added technology stocks, you know. So the way we actually measure ourselves, and this is more internal, more than external, you know, you guys look at how we've done against benchmark or peers or whatever, but we also see how our actions have actually added value. So, you know, so we look at ourselves versus our own stale portfolios, you know. So if you start on December 31st and you held a stale portfolio versus what you have as a portfolio now, how has your actual portfolio done as compared to a stale portfolio performance? And we've done reasonably well in that as well. So we've added a little bit of value. You know, some of it is, you know, being taking advantage of volatility in the markets. Some of it is repositioning, moving away from some of these, banking and levered companies into the tech companies, which have done quite well. And the other thing which we look at is, you know, we say sustainable earning power at a discount, and a good measure for us is really our relative return on assets of the companies which we own versus the price earning ratio of what we own as compared to the market. And we have remained in more profitable, less levered companies and at cheaper valuations as compared to the market. So to that extent, our portfolio is, reflects what we are really trying to do. And as I said, we've also added a little bit of value, not so much in the current year as well.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good combination of stocks then. Could you tell me a little bit more about Tencent Music? Because that was a stock, a spin-off from Tencent that you added to the portfolio. What do you like about Tencent Music?
Yeah, so we added it at a very opportune time, and the issue is also about weights. You know, you also mentioned that we are concentrated, but the fact is that, you know, we measure ourselves on active weights, and therefore, if there is a 8% weight in the index, and you are really liking the stock, and you want to be active weight, and you are at 10%, you can only add 2% of active weight. So to that extent, I think Tencent Music was a good ad. We got some exposure of it because it's owned by Tencent, but not to the extent which we wanted, and therefore we added Tencent Music at probably a very good time. So this company is a mixture of Spotify and things like Smule. I don't know whether you've seen that app. Smule. You have karaoke singing and live performances, etc. So they get revenue from two sources. One is subscription. As you know, the cost of content in China is still very low. And people don't really realize it, that the Chinese customer is paying a fraction for entertainment services as on a monthly subscription basis as compared to the Westerners. So one is that you're getting subscription revenue. The second is also you get the social revenue in this business because, you know, people like to so people are stuck at home. They want to sing with their friends. Then they have these virtual rooms and karaoke's and then you can also have these famous actors, famous singers come on to the platform and people like to sing along with the star, you know. Mm-hmm. So that is there. And then people, there's a tipping culture in China as well. So it's a very interesting business model.
It sounds fun, Chetan, and it's generating revenues, but is it generating profits, I wonder?
Yeah, so it is generating profits. It is generating a lot of cash flow. They also have a stake in Spotify. And as I said, the number of subscribers are increasing quite exponentially. They are still, you know, the paying ratio is still very low in China. So, you know, not only will the subscribers continue to grow, but also the over a period of time, the ASP and the revenue per subscriber will grow. They've also launched, the long form. So there's a group company called China Literature, which owns a lot of the literature. So they have these podcasts and these audiobooks as well on their platform. So it's a very interesting combination and very unique and generating cash. And that's why we find that company quite resilient. And then when we bought it, it was at a significant discount. You know, we took advantage of the market meltdown in adding to that stock.
Okay, well, thanks for talking about that stock. And going back to more of a sort of macroeconomic picture, just how are you viewing the forthcoming U.S. election? Because traditionally, you know, the direction of the dollar has a big influence on appetite or performance of emerging markets. So clearly, the political risks are rising as that contest is gets into full swing. How are you viewing it? What are the risks and opportunities that might come your way?
Yeah, so I think on the currency side, we don't take too much of a view on how the currencies are going to pan out and whether the US dollar will be strengthening or weakening. But the other thing which has happened is that, as I said, emerging markets are no longer dependent on commodities, which get impacted much more by interest rates as compared to the consumer side. And interest rates, by and large, nominal interest rates in most of the world are reasonably low, and there's no expectation that they will go up in a hurry. Whereas if you look at the election, I mean, for some sectors, there could be a lot of dramatic changes, like, for example, energy policy of the U.S. And on the geopolitics, there could be some changes, whether, the relationship with China will always come up or whether there's some kind of settlement with Iran or whatever, So those are there. But we don't look at it, I think the impact on emerging markets this time around will not be that significant. I think there are a lot of structures.
What about the tensions, Chetan? What about the tensions between the US and China? It seems that whoever ends up in the White House, those are going to remain as one superpower tries to face off another one. How exposed are you to the risk of sanctions and that sort of thing from the US against Chinese companies?
Yeah, so as I said, that those secular trends may not be a result of the election. So not too much might change, even if there's a change in guard at the White House. And you look at it from the perspective of China and the US, like So the US is, quite clear that they want clean networks and they want to have, control over the networks and the apps which are coming into the US. And I think the same is true with China as well, that, China doesn't allow all the apps to actually function in China similarly. So this is there. And over a period of time, I think, China is more dependent on US technology as compared to US being dependent on Chinese technology. So China has its task cut out that they need to build this. And I don't think they will stop their process, irrespective of who comes into the White House, because they want to have self-sufficiency and they're working towards, trying to have. I mean, it's going to be a very difficult, situation for them to do it over the next many decades. But China does want to have some self-sufficiency in technology resources. So I think that is a long-term trend, and there is a lot of pressure. So from our point of view, we look at sustainable earning power, and this is one of those important questions which we try to answer in our ownership of Samsung and TSMC. Because we think that these two companies, which are a large part of Temit portfolio, are quite resilient because we don't see either US nor China have the capacity to really move these two companies out of their supply chain. So to this extent, these two companies are quite resilient. There are moves which are making, some manufacturing is shifting around from Taiwan into China and from, so those things are happening. But we are very careful about those companies, which are benefiting at the current juncture because of one policy or the other. And therefore, we just keep stress testing our scenarios while making the ownership decision.
And looking at the global economy and how it's been affected by the pandemic, how resilient are these companies going to have to be? How testing are the economic conditions? Are you seeing China return to growth in the second quarter? Are you positive? Are you seeing the rebound continuing, or is it weakening? What's your view on the on economic growth overall?
So as a result of the pandemic, I think all economies have weakened, and the governments have more debt, and the consumers, the banks are more cautious, the consumer leverage is at risk. The only thing which is in favor is really that nominal interest rates are quite low, and therefore the governments feel that, the pain can be borne, which is there. But you have to also look at long-term trends, because As people invest in technology, there is also productivity being unleashed in the economy. A Zoom can do much more today, and we are having this conversation over Zoom. So to that extent, I think you have to keep that in mind as well, that there are secular trends which are at play, and therefore you need to be in companies which can take advantage of those secular trends. But on balance, I think overall economies will take a long time to come back to normal, and it'll take a long time. And we think that it's only a true normalization really is a 2022 kind of event, not even 2021, though we expect a vaccine in 2021.
Okay, and is that caution then, your caution about prospects expressed in the gearing? So the investment trust can borrow money to invest more on behalf of shareholders. You've got quite a substantial borrowing facility, but I think at the moment you're not using it, are you?
So we have used it. We have actually, half of the borrowing has actually been drawn down, and we've used it at times. For example, when there was market mayhem, the discount on the trust also widened, and so the board has a prerogative to do buybacks. So the buybacks are also taking place. We also took advantage, but we are actually quite tactical about it. We are, if we see the opportunity, we will invest. We will not really keep ourselves fully invested on a levered basis. Okay. So whenever the opportunity comes down, comes in, we actually use that as something.
But currently, are you geared or are you ungeared at the moment?
No. So we have drawn down the leverage, but we may not have fully deployed it in the market. Yeah.
All right. So there's a bit of cash there.
If
you want to use it. Got you. Okay. You mentioned the discount, actually. So yeah, at the moment, Templeton Emerging Markets shares are trading around 12% below their underlying net asset value, which so indicates it's a bit of a bargain there. You know, you're buying something 12% cheaper than it should be. But that's about the average of the past year. So it presumably widened out quite a lot in March, but it has come back in again. I'm just wondering, does the trust have a target around the discount? You know, with the buybacks that are trying to narrow that discount, what are they trying to achieve? What's the desired level?
So that the buybacks and all is really the prerogative of the board, and
of course,
so the board makes that decision. We've not really communicated any discount level or discount range, and really it is for the board to answer that question.
Fair enough. You're the fund manager. I understand.
Yeah, from my point of view, they expect me, to outperform the index and do well against the peers as well. And our belief is that if we continue to do that on an ongoing basis, then over a period of time, clients will have more faith and hopefully the discounts will narrow.
Yeah. Okay. And in thinking of your job as the fund manager, you're not working alone. Of course, you've got teams of analysts to help you in the various offices around the world. But you've also got a co-manager in Andrew Ness, who joined you also in 2018. But he's based in Edinburgh, and you're based in Singapore. How does that work? How do the two of you work together over such a distance?
Yeah, so the previous manager Carlos was also based in the UK, and we used to interact as well. And you must remember that we are really an emerging markets team. We have 80 analysts, portfolio managers located all over the world, and so and in fact actually things have only got better, because our structure was like this even in the early 1990s when travel was not there, communication equipment was not there, there was no Zoom, etc. So now it's actually become much more easier to communicate. Andrew, adds a lot of perspective, a very different perspective. So we both have really spent 25 years in emerging markets each, and we have totally different we have experiences which we can share with each other, and so he brings a different lens, and it's always very good to have this camaraderie and people challenging each other. And the best thing is if you really work in a as friends and colleagues more than anything else, because the process is really to come up with the best ideas for the trust, so there's no and if the trust does well, both of us do well. So mm-hmm. So as long as the objective is the same, then there's no issue at all.
Okay. That makes sense. It's a global portfolio, so it's good to have people dotted around in key locations. I'm getting towards the end of my questions, but I'm curious about the dividend, because Templeton Emerging Markets is primarily a growth investment fund, looking to increase shareholders' capital through investing in the themes and the opportunities that you've been talking about, growth in the middle classes, and just generally the fact that there's lots of good companies in the countries you're investing in. But the trust has quite a big amount of revenue reserves to support the dividend, and the dividend growth has been quite good in recent years, and the trust yields 2.5%. I'm just wondering, my question is the dividend becoming a more important part for this growth fund?
Yeah, so I think it's for the board to answer in terms of the payout ratio. But generally, I think the board has distributed the earned dividends. And luckily for us, there have been improvements in corporate governance within emerging markets. So companies are generating much more free cash flow. And this is all prior to COVID, and COVID changes a little bit. But companies were sharing a lot of the cash flows they were generating, and they were also doing buybacks. And the free cash flow being generated by the emerging market corporate was actually getting higher and higher as a percentage of the overall world index. So generally, emerging market companies were generating more free cash flow and distributing that with better corporate governance. So, and we were just actually transmitting the dividends earned to the unit holders. Obviously, with this pandemic, you know, some of the banks have been asked not to pay out the dividends, and you know, companies have become slightly more cautious on payouts. So there could be an impact this year on the earned dividends. But again, it's for the trust to make the board to make the decision of how much to actually pay out, and that is a prerogative of the board as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure on dividends everywhere, but it is reassuring to know that there's extra money in the reserves to support the dividend if the board want to do that. Clearly, there's a lot of interest amongst investors, income investors, in the dividends that trusts like yours pay. Just picking up on your points about sort of governance, ESG has become a huge issue for investors and fund managers nowadays. When you're looking for sustainable returns from the companies you're investing in, you know, how important are that trio of factors, the environment, the social policies, and the governance of the companies you're investing in? I expect you're going to say that you've been taking those into account always, ever since you started in the job. What is the position on ESG?
Yeah, so I think governance is not just when I took the job, but even when Mark was running it, you know, governance was, I think, one of the most important things which used to fight, sometimes fight with companies on. And, you know, we had these cases which we had. So governance is always very important. And I think that's very critical, that governance, is an important part of shareholder returns. Because companies then, you know, can sit on excess capital or can return capital to shareholders. So capital allocation is a result of governance. I think on the E and S, again, it's important to look at it because, first of all, Andrew is one of our leads in terms of the ESG factors and stewardship per se, given his background, etc. But on E and S, we have to factor in these elements. Otherwise, we'll not be able to arrive at sustainable earning. So, for example, you know, we have cement companies in our portfolio, companies manufacturing cement, and it is very important because the cost of the environment is actually going up. And these companies are supposed to, you know, pay for carbon. So if you don't factor that in, how do you actually factor in sustainable earnings? So the good thing about ENS is that the governments are also very aware that companies need to focus on ENS. And the companies realize that the more they delay, the higher there will be a cost. So I'll give you an example. Like, for example, the automobile industry in China, the automobile industry in China, there are very, very strict rules on the number of battery vehicles which need to be there and on emission, etc. So if the companies are not launching battery vehicles, then the cost for the internal combustion engine goes up quite a lot. So I think we have to factor that in, because unless we factor that in, we will not be able to arrive at what we consider sustainable earnings from companies.
That makes a lot of sense, Chetan. Just want to clarify, you used the term ENS. What does that mean?
E and S.
E Sorry. And S. Beg your pardon. Sorry. That's my hearing or the connection. Well, Chetan, thanks very much for your time. I think that's all the questions I've got. It seems that, how would you sum up, traditionally global emerging markets seen as a volatile asset class, and clearly there's lots of uncertainty. There always is, but there's particularly heightened uncertainty at the moment. What would be your key message to investors who are, not sure about whether to have exposure to emerging markets in their savings?
Yeah, so I think you have to go back to the basics, that emerging markets are over 35% of global GDP, and therefore they merit some investment. And the trust is a good way because it gives you a diversified range of companies, and even at a discount, as you mentioned, there's a discount which is there in the market. And our performance has been reasonably good over the last few years, and we have a diversified portfolio. We believe that emerging markets will continue. You know, there's a lot of change and innovation which is happening in emerging markets. Many of the companies are very, very resilient. We've started seeing global leadership coming out of emerging market companies. You know, you talked about the trends on internet, retail, semiconductors. All these are very, very powerful trends, and they will remain with us for a very, very long time. Now, even in the new industries, you know, for example, if you look at electric vehicles, which we didn't talk about, but the battery suppliers for the electric vehicles are basically all emerging. Most of them are emerging market companies. So there are very, very solid trends. There's more electronics in the vehicle. So, you know, if you look at a car today, it has far more electronics. And again, electronics is coming from most of the emerging markets. Pure consumer countries like India, where, you know, there's a lot of growth potential still left. Brazil, there's a lot of growth potential still left. So emerging markets, as you know, is a wide array and a basket of countries, each of which has their own opportunities, and there are many good companies. So, you know, there are over 20,000 companies which are listed, and for our portfolio, we just need to find a few which will do well. And that's our belief in emerging markets and ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds, from a UK perspective, it sounds like a good way to get diversification and increase the opportunity set of finding the good companies that you're talking about. Well, thanks very much for talking to me, Chetan, and look forward to seeing how you get on in the months and the years ahead. But in the meantime, all the best, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you.